So I now want to turn the mic over to the president of the Academy, Ralph Cicerone. He has worked for a long time in atmospheric chemistry, climate change, and energy, and he's really been instrumental in shaping environmental science and policy for some decades. I think in particular in my former capacity as director of the Office of the USGCRP and the Climate Change Science Program of the critical role that he played in the transition from the Clinton administration to the Bush administration. And so, Ralph, we just wanted to ask you to come up and give some thoughts on this moment of transition for our board.
Thank you, Richard, and also for taking on this board chairmanship, and to all the members of the new board. This is, a brand new opportunity, and I hope that over the years you'll accomplish a great deal. You know, you said, Richard, that looking over there, you could see some evidence of the accomplishments of the predecessor of this group, like the Committee on the Human Dimensions of Global Change and the Board on Global Change. I looked around the room, and I could see evidence of things, too, like Terry Chapin's beard is largely gray now, and saw Dennis Ujima here, and the hair used to be black. I was very happy to see Maria Carmen. These look about the same. That's great. But some of the rest of us have really aged. Richard, your hair used to be kind of brown, didn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway. But seriously, I'm really happy I could join you for a few minutes. There's so many thoughts that come back to me over where this community and its predecessors have been and where we ought to be going. I made a couple of notes that I want to refer to. First of all, the origins of the United States Global Change Program. Probably there are a couple of people in the room who really know the story, like Bob Correll, and Richard probably does too. But a couple of memories that I have are, everybody knows the yeoman work that Jack Eddy did in the early to mid-80s, putting together the intellectual case, if you will, the substantive case for what were the problems, how were they connected, and what kind of a scientific effort would it take to get into them. And in a way, some of it had already been done by Francis Bretherton's committee at NASA, the Earth System Science Committee, with those big wiring diagrams. And in a way, there was a predecessor to that. Richard Goody led a report with NASA and JPL in 1981 and 2 called Global Habitability. And it was seen as a curveball at the scientific community because the scientific community was solid Earth geophysicists who thought that the next mission to planet Earth was going to be looking at tectonic movements and volcanoes, and Richard kind of threw them a curveball, as I remember, that instead the challenge was going to be these human-driven environmental programs. Bob, that might be quite wrong. A little right on? Okay. But I want to say something, that right from the beginning, the centrality of the human role was recognized, and yet, in terms of the program priorities, that it never made it. That is the central role of human activities. And the question is why. Now, I was not a principal architect of any of those reports, but Jack Eddy and I were very close. And we were kind of outcasts at NCAR, and we were proud of it. And I'd spent a lot of time with Jack. And I know that he personally had a strong view of the centrality of the human causes of the problems and the future challenges, the ones that Richard just referred to. How do humans get hold of gauging their own activities, let alone optimizing them, and that would be an enormous challenge. Jack understood this. I mean, his own scientific work was based partly on his readings of records of the American Indians in the Southwest, how they responded to climate change, and how this, in turn, was probably driven by solar variability, which had only been recorded in historical documents that were really not available through physical measurements. So Jack got it. And yet, the human dimension side of it, as it was called in those days, never got into program priorities. And as I remember it, the reason was that it was everybody's judgment, including Jack's, that the world wasn't ready for it. For two reasons. One is that the scope of the physical science and maybe the biological science that had to be done and the difficulties in making the case were large enough that was a big enough challenge to handle, thank you, at the time. and that it could endanger the whole effort by bringing in the social sciences at the time. Bob, do you agree with that? It was a judgment. I think people, and I certainly was aware of it, feared the kind of backlash, not only in society at large, but in federal agencies who had to fight for the resources and other people who were going to do the work, that there would be a backlash if everything were mounted at once. And that's just the truth as I remember it. So that was the basis of the judgment. I have a lot of other things which I'm not going to talk about, but as I say, the awareness of the centrality of the behavioral sciences and of human behavior itself was quite strong right from the beginning. So if you fast forward, though, to, let's say, the last decade, the 2000s, it just became increasingly clear from every sober assessment and evaluation of what was going on that ducking of the issue could no longer be maintained. That is, the assessments that came out of the Global Change Program itself, that Bob and Richard oversaw in some cases, but also the Bush administration Climate Change Science Program, and a number of academy reports just kept saying the same thing, that to better understand the changes that were underway, to be able to estimate at all their future course, let alone to mitigate those changes and to slow them down, and possibly to have to adapt to them in a way that wouldn't be too disruptive to society, was simply going to have to involve the social and behavioral sciences, whether he liked it or not. So the crescendo, I think, of agreement on that issue, I think, eventually won the day. But I want to mention one more thing about that characterizes the challenge here. There is no scientific discipline that I know of, whether it's in the physical sciences or mathematics or biology or social and behavioral sciences, where the practitioners of that specialty, the experts that we need, the people who really have the deepest understanding, where they want to be told what to do. They don't want that their specialty should be seen as in service to somebody else. There are no mathematicians I know who, for very long, will tolerate a view of themselves that they only exist to solve my equations, because I told Richard, the mathematician, that's his job. They're physicists who simply don't like to work on somebody else's agenda. It's just kind of the way people grow up. And I presume that's very true in the social and behavioral sciences. So somehow, and I know there's been progress made, but of this board on environmental change in society, part of your challenge, I think, is to find the people who have already concluded that the issues that are of most interesting, that deserve their attention, are not just in the service of somebody else's agenda. Am I saying this well? Because if you simply try to convince a field that here are their 8 priorities because you told them so, it just doesn't work. They won't follow the money. They don't do what you tell them. They have to have an inherent interest no matter what their field of science is. So as you do your work, let me know how that goes, because you need the inputs of people who are specializing in things which may not even seem connected, or they may seem connected, but they're simply not going to want to work on the problems that you tell them to unless they find them inherently interesting. So I think that's a challenge that's always been around. So thank you very much, and I look forward to listening to Bill Riley.